Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio.
Good morning and welcome. Today is Thursday, June 7th, day 158 of the year 2018. So glad to have you tuned in to Faith Radio. I'm Neil Stavem. This is Faith Radio Mornings. Sitting in this morning and looking forward to a good morning ahead and some great conversations scheduled to go. And think about today, one of the events in history. Don't know how significant it is, but 1955, the $64,000 question premiered on television. A few years before that, though, there was something much more significant. Yesterday, you may recall, was the anniversary of D-Day on June 6th of 1944. More than 160,000 Allied troops landed along a 50-mile stretch of heavily fortified French coastline to fight Nazi Germany on the beaches of Normandy, France. Logan, I don't know about you, but I think you realize how many young men of your age were in those crafts, landing on the beach. That would have been a fearful day.
Even younger than me. I'm only 22.
That's right, yes. And think about that.
Yeah, there's a lot of comparisons to that good old millennial generation off complaining about things, while the best generation was off fighting wars.
Oh, 5,000 ships, 13,000 aircraft, and it was a costly day. More than 9,000 Allied soldiers killed or wounded, but their sacrifice allowed more than 100,000 soldiers to begin the slow, hard slog across Europe to eventually defeat Hitler. So a significant turning point today. I was thinking about Winston Churchill. Of course, lots of wonderful movies have come out over the last couple of years. Thinking about World War II and Winston Churchill. I don't know if you've seen that.
I've not seen the Churchill one.
It's on my list to do. But Churchill said, courage is what it takes to stand up and speak. Courage is also what it takes to sit down and listen. Now, we don't really like that part so much. we'll do a little listening as we go on throughout the day. Coming up a bit later this morning, Jim Moore, who's with Minnesota Teen Challenge, is going to join us. And we're going to talk about the opioid epidemic. And that is a crisis that we want to address. And in a few minutes, Ben Johnson from the Acton Institute will join us. He's pretty much a regular guest with us, and we're going to talk Ireland particularly and the decision there to legalize abortion. We'll get some perspective from Ben Johnson on that coming up in a few minutes. Thinking about today, though, waking up this morning and thinking 1944, you heard yesterday Breakpoint perhaps, the reflections about how many prayer services were going on over the 24 hours or more that D-Day invasion was going on, and thank God for that that important change in history, the course of history. Billy Graham said this, and with us we'll go into break. Courage is contagious. When a brave man takes a stand, the spines of others are often stiffened. We were made to be courageous. Well, that's the walk-up music from Ben Johnson from the Acton Institute. He is with us on the line this morning here. Faith Radio Morning's underway on a Thursday, 9 past the hour. Ben, good morning to you. Thanks for coming back on with us.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me on, Neil.
Looking forward to the conversation today. We want to focus our attention, the beginning of our conversation at least, on events and decisions in Ireland not too long ago, and just kind of look back on that that vote that changed the abortion ruling there. Give us a little summary of what the status was before and then what that vote actually said.
Well, sure. In the Republic of Ireland, this is Southern Ireland, the Constitution formerly had said that the states acknowledged the right to life of the unborn. That was the wording of the Eighth Amendment of the Constitution. And just a few weeks ago, over the weekend, the Irish voters went to the polls and repealed Article 8 of the Constitution. They replaced it with new wording, which says, rather than acknowledging the right to life of the unborn, it says, quote, provision may be made by law for the regulation of termination of pregnancies. So previously they'd acknowledged a pre-existing right that everyone has given by God in order to have the right to life. And now they say that the government has the right for termination of pregnancies. The government's made it very clear that abortion can go forward at least for the first 12 weeks of pregnancy, as well as various other conditions which will liberalize abortion law after that. So the media environment up to this point was incredibly biased. The Irish Times, for example, according to one estimate, ran 91% of its coverage pro-abortion in favor of repealing the Eighth. Even the conservative media in Ireland was largely in favor of repealing the Eighth. It was incredibly trendy. But when you look at the brass tacks of what this will do, this is going to liberalize abortion law in the same way that abortion was liberalized in this country under the purview of trying to save women's lives and the health of the mother. And that's exactly the Trojan horse that they use to smuggle in abortion on demand in the United States. And that's what's going to happen in the Republic of Ireland now, sadly.
So right now it's up to 12 weeks, of course, in America, abortion on demand right through a full term. So I guess we can expect that if the trends move in that same direction, that's where we're headed for Ireland as well.
And not simply Southern Ireland. This morning there's breaking news that the Supreme Court of the U.K. has just barely stopped short of overturning Northern Ireland's abortion law. Mm. There was the Northern Ireland Council on Human Rights, the Northern Ireland Human Rights Commission, sued Northern Ireland under the EU law, saying that its pro-life abortion law, which only allows for abortion in the case to save the life of the mother, is, and this is a quote, inhuman and degrading and causes physical and mental torture to women. Now, abortion itself is pretty torturous for the child, particularly after 20 weeks when the child can feel pain. But nonetheless, the UK Supreme Court ruled that the Human Rights Commission doesn't have standing to bring this. You have to be an actual victim of the law in order to bring this case. However, they said if they had had a victim, they would have ruled to overrule Northern Ireland's pro-life law, at least in the cases of rape, incest, for fetal abnormality, and for the health of the mother, which is exactly how abortion on demand was smuggled into the United States. You know, Ronald Reagan always said that the greatest regret that he ever had in 1967 was he was brand new governor of California, was signing the Therapeutic Abortion Act. But it was sold to him on the grounds that women were suffering and this would protect their health. And very soon the idea of a woman's health was expanded to the point of mental health, where if a doctor said that she would have any kind of regret, then that was considered a violation of women's health, and abortion was essentially legalized for abortion on demand. So you have a referendum in Southern Ireland now affecting Northern Ireland, and there are calls for the Prime Minister of the UK, a member of the Conservative Party, but she's pro-abortion, Theresa May, to impose abortion on demand on Northern Ireland, and a government that has been voted in by the people, and the government of Northern Ireland does not want abortion on demand.
Just thinking, it's a little bit ironic, isn't it, that an organization called a human rights organization doesn't deal with humans at the very youngest, which is, I guess, often the case when it comes to this battle, that age doesn't seem to be a factor here, does it?
Well, it's funny. You know, the way this is being reported in the international media is that Northern Ireland's law is violating human rights. So essentially they're saying that protecting life and recognizing the right to life violates human rights. So how you can come to that conclusion is beyond anyone's understanding. But basically what's happening with our brothers over on the other side of the sea is that they're walking down one of two paths, and neither one of them represents the will of the people. Either the Prime Minister of UK is going to impose abortion on demand on Northern Ireland, which violates its own internal order, because that's supposed to be a local decision. It's supposed to be up to Northern Ireland to decide for itself, and the government of Northern Ireland does not want abortion on demand. But the UK Supreme Court made clear today that if Prime Minister May doesn't, and the Human Rights Commission brings this case before them, then the UK Supreme Court will impose abortion, at least in those instances, on Northern Ireland, just the way they did here in the United States. So the law has saved about 100,000 lives, and we could see the end of the most pro-life country in Europe within our time, with a complete and utter disregard for the will of the people along the way.
I know part of this now is what also to establish some buffer zones around abortion facilities, right, so that there wouldn't be someone too close when to be offering some counsel or some advice.
Well, that's another issue that we have in common across the Atlantic as well. Of course, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that a certain length or a certain bubble zone, so-called, my friends in the pro-life movement like to call a free speech free zone, where free speech has been restricted, has been set up. And they've ruled that that violates the Constitution if it's at least of a certain area. But over in the UK, that's something that is again presented as though it supports human rights.
Ben Johnson is with the Acton Institute, and he comes on regularly here on Faith Radio Mornings. Glad to have him with us this morning, talking about decisions, voting and the court decisions in Ireland and the impact on life. We're going to continue that conversation in a moment. Also want to talk a little bit about what's happening in Spain, and we're going to talk about millennials, all that coming up in the moments ahead. You're listening to Faith Radio Mornings, and we'll be back in a moment, 17 past the hour. Past the hour on a Thursday morning on Faith Radio Morning. I'm Neil Stavins. And then today, nice to have you along. Ben Johnson from the Acton Institute is with us. We're talking a little bit about Ireland's vote, voting yes on abortion and no to the sanctity of life. I was noticing, Ben, that in Ireland particularly, that the younger the age, the more they were voting in favor of this. In the U.S., it seems the opposite, that the younger the age, the more pro-life. The numbers reversed in Ireland. Is that just because of maybe effective marketing?
It has a lot to do with that. In Ireland, of course, you have a nation in the Republic of Ireland, Southern Ireland, a nation that has been dominated by the Catholic Church. It's overwhelmingly Catholic, and repealing the Eighth was shown and marketed as a way to destroy the political power of the Catholic Church. So it was a very trendy thing for millennials who are, as we know, also most likely to be the so-called nun generation, those who don't belong to any church. That trend is holding true in Ireland as well. So this was deliberately staged and marketed as an attempt to battle back the power of the Catholic Church. In the United States, of course, millennials are also most likely to be members of the nun generation, not to believe in any particular denomination or even religion, but still to believe in God or to be spiritual, so-called. But in the United States, there's been a different emphasis, which is that we have this emphasis on science and ultrasounds. And as people look at ultrasounds, they find that what they're looking at is not what Planned Parenthood had sold them. It's not a clump of cells, an undifferentiated mass of biological tissue. What they're looking at is a human being, and in fact, it's their own DNA, as well as that of their husband or wife. And that's what's looking at them in the face and begging them for their love and attention.
Yeah, you know, speaking of trying to take down the institution, religious institutions, I know you've been following what's going on in Spain, new socialist government there. That can have some implications for the church there, right?
In a major way, we were speaking about the lack of democracy. Spain just has a brand new prime minister who's never been elected and has less than 25% of all the seats in parliament. So 25%, he has 24% of the seats, 84 out of 350. The man's name is Pedro Sanchez. He's the leader of the Spanish Socialist Party. And what had happened was the previous prime minister who had been elected was part of the People's Party. They'd been caught benefiting from kickbacks and bribery. So Pedro Sanchez had pushed through a no-confidence vote. Now, in most countries, when you have a no-confidence vote, you get a brand-new election, and people get to vote on who will replace the prime minister. The way that it works in Spain, in the no-confidence resolution itself, you name the person who will take over as prime minister. And Pedro Sanchez, you know, nominated Pedro Sanchez. So there genuinely was a problem. He capitalized on it, and with the support of some radical left-wing organizations like Podemos and other radical left parties, including some Marxists and communists, he was elected. So the Socialist Party now, although it's a minority party in the extreme, controls the government. That's dangerous for the church for one reason, which is that Sanchez has tried to eliminate or at least marginalize the teaching of religion in schools in places where the Socialist Party is in charge in Spain. Religion teachers have said that they've suffered discrimination at the hands of the government. And one of the issues that's of particular importance that might pique some of your listeners' curiosity, he wants to tax churches on any real estate that they own that's not used for worship. And that rings a bell here in the United States. You remember Barack Obama always talked about the freedom of worship, and yet he was always making a distinction between worship and other the free exercise of religion. So he was always trying to crack down on the church in areas outside of Sunday morning worship or Saturday for Jews. He was always trying to crack down on free ministries. So essentially, of the exact same division that Barack Obama used, I'm not sure who influenced whom, whether the socialist influenced Obama or Obama influenced the Spanish socialists. But essentially, the government is trying to tax churches in order to take over the ministries that the churches are providing to the poor and to the dispossessed. And this isn't just the government expanding at the church's expense. It's really about socialist government driving the church out of ministries that Jesus Christ demanded of her when he said, "Come, follow me."
It's amazing that socialism still has such a foothold in many places around the globe. Ben Johnson is with the Acton Institute. Ben, we have just a couple minutes left, and I know that you've written something or writing about a young millennial that is getting a lot of attention recently, this 30-year-old who got evicted from his parents' house.
It's an incredibly sad story. Michael Rotundo, the first time I heard it, I thought it was the professional wrestler Michael Rotundo, but turns out it's a different gentleman altogether. That probably says more about my lowbrow interest than anything else, the way I misspent my youth. But Michael Rotundo, 30-year-old in a suburb of Syracuse, New York, has been living with his parents for 8 years rent-free. He's never contributed anything, not only in terms of economic resources, but also to upkeep of the house, doing any of the chores. And his parents have told him that he needs to get a job. He took them to court and said he had the right to stay in their house rent-free. In this country, the government ruled in favor of the parents. They said, "Come on, you're an adult. you're in their house. They have a right to regulate their own house, and you're an adult. Come on, step up." However, in Europe, there's a growing trend which has been going on for years upon years where courts have ruled in favor of the millennials. So you have the exact same thing happening in Europe, only in reverse. Courts are actually ruling that parents have a legal obligation in some cases to allow 30-year-olds to stay in their home rent-free until they can find a job. For example, one of them is 30 years old and sued because he couldn't find a job in the same area that he got his master's degree in. And the court ruled that the parents have to support him until he can find a job in his chosen field. So here you have the government talking and ruling in the most intimate relations humanly possible, the relationship between a father or a mother and their own children. You literally have a nanny state developing around us in Europe, and you have to watch that because, as I always tell people, if you want to know what's going to happen in the United States in 15 or 20 years, watch Europe and Canada today.
We have talked Ireland, Spain, and Europe in general, and then maybe coming to a shore near us sooner than later. Ben Johnson from the Acton Institute giving us an update today. Ben, I always appreciate you coming on with us, and wish you a great day.
Thank you. You as well. God bless.
You're listening to Faith Radio Mornings here. We're at 27 past the hour, and coming up in a moment, we're going to hear Ken Davis explain how he gets events booked. You want to listen in for Lighten Up just ahead. All right, we're 30 minutes past the hour, and we're underway on Faith Radio Mornings. I'm Neil Stavem, sitting in today. Glad to have you along here. Coming up in the next half hour, I'm going to visit with Jim Moore. Jim is with the R3 Collaborative. We're going to talk particularly about an epidemic that affects so many, a growing number. It's the world of opioids, a word that we probably didn't even know just a few years ago, and now it's become an epidemic. We'll find out more about that in the moments ahead here on Faith Radio Morning. Stay tuned. It's a Thursday morning, June 7th. Month of June, often considered wedding months. Maybe you've got an anniversary this month or know someone who's getting married, or you want to just improve your marriage. Before looking at improving your marriage, Craig Groeschel says we need to first look at our relationship with God.
Ultimately, when we idolize someone else, if I look to Amy and say, she's the one who's supposed to meet my needs, then when she doesn't, you know, I'm frustrated with her and I blame her. And so that goes really back to putting God as number one above anything else, that I need to get my identity from Him. I need to find my security in Him. We need to find fulfillment in Him, our calling through Him. And then when I go to a marriage more whole and complete because of Him, I'm better equipped to love Amy in the way that she deserves, and she's better equipped to respond to me. And so that's one of the things I really think that is a big challenge for couples, is to learn to get their identity first, their security, their meaning from God alone. And then we really are truly better equipped to show His kind of love to one another out of a response to His love, rather than trying to get our needs met through our spouse, which if that's all we're doing, we're going to end up frustrated.
Pastor and author Craig Groeschel talking about keeping the marriage vows from a conversation on Faith Radio early. You can search for that and find out more. Go to myfaithradio.com. Look for, put in the word vow, or maybe this day forward. You'll get some encouragement on marriage from Craig Groeschel. Finding your identity and your security in God first and foremost. There's so many people that are looking for their security, their hope in something called an opioid. And we're going to hear about that and the danger of that addiction in the moments ahead. Jim Moore from R3 Collaborative is with us in a minute here on the Early Morning Late Show. It's not the Early Morning Late Show anymore. It's Faith Radio Mornings. That's what it is. It's 37 past the hour.
Persecution in this country? It's already here. This is Jim Garlow. We look at other parts of the world, we pray for the persecuted church, and well, we should. All it takes for us to experience full-fledged persecution is to not be protected by good laws, by not having righteous people interpreting and enforcing those good laws. It's naive to assume, even though we have good laws, that that's all we need. No, if we have wicked individuals interpreting or enforcing them, that's a problem. Just ask churches who stood for traditional marriage. Ask business owners who've provided services based on biblical values. Ask individuals who've prayed in schools or at public events. Ask them what happened. Lawsuits? Fines? Reputation smeared? Buildings defaced? Sound familiar? Persecution is not simply coming to America at some point. It's here. This is our moment to stand. There's more at jimgarlow.com.
If you need freedom, save it. He's a prison-shaking savior. If you got chains, he's a chain breaker.
And we're going to talk today about breaking some chains, some hope for those that are facing addictions. And my guest is Jim Moore. Jim is with the R3 Collaborative. We're going to find out more about that in a moment. R3Collaborative.org is the website, by the way. And Jim is here to talk about the opioid epidemic. And Jim, actually, one of the reasons we want Jim on is because his voice sounds so good. I mean, he should be in radio. Man, so, Jim, good to see you. Thank
I'm
you,
in radio now.
So we're going to talk about the opioid epidemic.
And,
we've used those words together now. I mean, it wasn't that long ago. We probably had no idea what the word opioid meant, and now we've have to put epidemic with it. Is it really an epidemic?
You know, it really is an epidemic if you consider that addiction is a chronic disease. And that's from the medical community. That's from the government. That's people have identified it. Now, a lot of folks will look at it as a moral failure. Well, yeah, so it's and, not or. But once someone gets engaged with opioids and the door locks behind them, then it gets in your brain, and it is a physical condition, a disease. And when this many people die from it, and when it spreads like wildfire, I think epidemic is the word.
It's, I mean, it is spreading like wildfire, isn't
like
it?
Like wildfire. Yeah. I mean, the deaths passing, automobile deaths, and it's young people. I mean, that's the face. That's a face as a young girl and a young boy coming out of high school or in college, finding some pills in grandma's cabinet and, oh, that's no big deal. Yeah. And then when you run out of grandma's pills, it's $50 a pill and heroin's $5. So hence the doorway opens and locks behind you.
More addictive than, I mean, we've had drug addiction issues for centuries, right? Well, for certainly for
my lifetime. Well, I grew up in the 60s.
Sure.
And it was what you got.
Yeah.
I mean, just the wave. And then those waves have just come decade after decade with cocaine and then morphed into crack cocaine. And then the 90s and the 2000s, methamphetamine, just which had been around since the 60s, but it just hit a spark in rural America. So if you just it's just fascinating for me being involved in the field for 10 years just to see how it's grown. And then I remember 10 years ago in drug coalition meetings, their opioids started appearing as a blip, a fraction of a percent. Oh, no big deal. It's a fraction of 1%. But it was, look at it, it's quadrupling every year. Oh, it's less than a percent, and now a full-blown epidemic.
And is it, like you said, meth, that sort of happened in rural areas, got going? That so is opioids, is there an age group, a sort of social subset where it's most prevalent?
Well, I think people traditionally think of the inner-city drug addict on the street with a needle in their arm, but prescription pills changed the game because that was spread like wildfire across the country. So now it becomes a suburban phenomena, an urban phenomena. I mean, wherever there's a pharmacy, you know.
We do like to assign blame when problems grow. So are the pharmaceuticals to blame for this one?
I think we all got a little bit of a blame. I think the biggest blame, we have to look inside ourselves if we're going to really take responsibility for this thing. And the whole microwave culture, instant gratification, and that spreads into pain control. And that was what was going on in the 90s. Oh, these people are suffering. They shouldn't have to suffer at all. Let's squelch it. So that need for instant gratification instead of – or instant pain relief or total pain relief, I think, went in. But then the pharmaceuticals stepped in the vacuum, and then the medical community jumped on board, and there are profit and business drivers, but there's not a malicious intent. You know, people didn't intentionally launch an opioid epidemic, but unintended consequences. That's what we've experienced.
Well, maybe talk about those that become addicted. Is the issue pain control for a young person's life as well? Is that why they're pursuing chemicals to start with?
In many cases, I think one thing you need to look at with any kind of addiction is cause versus symptom. The drug addiction is the symptom of a deeper cause. So pain may well be it, but maybe not physiological pain. I think that's what gets someone coming out of a dental office or coming out of surgery to get involved. How about emotional pain? How about a sense of being disconnected? How about a frustration with one's world? But I think the first doorway, in all honesty, is party. I mean, come on. Yeah. You get it. Most people get involved with it like a flirtation.
Sure.
You know, try a few of these. And you get involved. And then it brings its own pain. Because if you don't take more, oh, you want pain. I've never experienced opioid addiction, but my son has, almost lost him to it. And the pain of withdrawal, from my understanding of people who have gone through it, is one of the worst pains of all.
Because this is amazingly addictive, isn't it?
It is. And it's subtle, because the first couple of times, oh, that's no big deal. Yeah. But then it just, like I said, the door closes behind you. And then all of a sudden you're in a windowless room and there ain't no way out. Well, there is, but there doesn't appear to be. But there ain't no shortcut. It's a long cut. It's a long way out.
Well, we're going to talk about the way out in a moment, because we want to have a conversation that's focusing on hope. We talk about the news of the day with a perspective of hope, and Jim Moore is here to help us do that. Jim is with the R3 Collaborative. We'll talk a little bit about that and about the great work of ministries like Teen Challenge. We'll get to all that in just a moment. Here's 44 past the hour. Past the hour, focusing on hope here for a few minutes as we talk about overcoming addictions and recovery. Jim Moore is with the R3 Collaborative, and he's worked in association with the Minnesota Teen Challenge, and has, from a personal family experience, knowing the pain of addictions and knowing that there are solutions. But as you said, Jim, just before the break, there's not a short term solution for overcoming.
No, there is a way out, and I visit a lot of groups, and I kind of advocate for treatment, and particularly post treatment. And I always tell people there's a way out, but there ain't no shortcut. Mm-hmm. Now I'm talking chronic addiction. I'm talking opioids, methamphetamine, alcohol. What we at Teen Challenge would focus on. You don't do a year program. You know, unless it's a chronic ingrained condition, and 30 days in a treatment program, I mean, you clear your mind. You can put a plan together, but it takes 6 to 9 months to detox from opioids. I mean, think of that. You're not even close to being detoxed after your 30-day treatment, after your intervention. So there is a long cut, but there's a way out, and there's freedom. You just gotta take some time.
But that, as you said, we're a microwave society, so somehow we think, well, 30 days should be enough, right?
Yeah.
And if your mind clears, you think, well, I must be okay.
Yeah, so. And you do that. And it's such contrast to what you've been experiencing in the last several months or several years. Good to go out there. And there's a lot of research that euphoric post-short-term treatment, that can last, it usually does, for about 30 days. 88% of the people who go to an initial 30-day treatment relapse. Typically within 30 to 90 days. So it's a chronic situation.
You know, groups like Teen Challenge have been in business for years. There's, of course, Union Gospel Missions, there's Salvation Army Recovery Centers. I mean, and they're looking at the long haul, aren't they, and the long taking it step by step.
You know, it's always been that way. Teen Challenge, if you go back, it started with a one-year discipleship program, streets in New York City, around heroin addiction. That was 1956. And so, you know, it was, again, when it was that inner city phenomena. But it was always that one-year program. But the treatment field kind of stuck on 30 days. But in the last couple of years, that's changing. Research shows the longer you stay in treatment, the higher the probability you can sustain sobriety. Not to be institutionalized, but the longer you stay in treatment. So now Hazelden, sure, they have the 30-day program, but they have a wonderful 6-month extension program in St. Paul, where it's kind of transitional, but ongoing therapy, ongoing treatment, ongoing medications, just to let the cement dry on that initial treatment.
So are there some breakthroughs? I mean, if we're going to recognizing there needs to be a longer approach, are there other sort of hopeful signs in this fight?
You know, sitting right here right now being on this show, public awareness, waking people up, an awakening, the government's awakening, the crisis of all the debts. And of all of that tragedy, there is an awakening happening. So that's a great sign, because that means resources are being directed towards it. People are changing the way they see these drug addicts from these moral failure criminals to, hey, that's somebody's kid who 6 months ago was anxious in high school, and now they're strung out on heroin sitting in a street corner in St. Paul. And so that awareness is building. But what, to me, the most exciting thing that's building is this long-term realization, Neil, and the need for not just an extended treatment program, but for long-term recovery. And that's why R3 exists. And when people get out of treatment, when people get out of prison, because most people coming out of prison have some, 80% have some kind of drug addiction going on, and they can't, even they've been in prison for 10 years. They get high within a half hour. It's just that psychological addiction too. So with more treatment services, more treatment programs, more long-term treatment programs, increased money being assigned to that because it's very costly, that's a great sign. But again, I'm excited about the post-treatment recovery. I'm excited to see treatment providers, instead of competing with each other for business, locking arms. 23 million Americans have been assessed as in need of treatment. 2.3 million are in treatment or getting that treatment. 90% are looking for a place. So a lot of there's a thing called the Professional Outreach Networking Group, which is Hazelden, Teen Challenge, Meridian Behavioral Health, are all coming together. Mutual referrals. Let's go after the 90%. Okay. And so that's a positive thing. But the one thing that I had mentioned to you the other day is this idea of there's a new professional role that people in recovery can play. And that is a peer recovery support specialist. And this is just, this is a brand new thing. I mean, it's not going to be formalized until July, but I'm sitting in on Teen Challenge's first peer recovery support specialist training. This is where people in recovery can do an extensive training program and then become a professional peer recovery support specialist. So sponsors are great in the AA tradition, mentors are great, but we're talking about skilled, professionally trained people who have not just been trained as a peer recovery support specialist, they've been trained for 10 years as an addict. Transform people. You know what I mean? And that's kind of the theory of it. So the troops are rallying. Being a faith-based kind of guy, I'm thinking he's stirring the waters. I'm thinking there's something going on. There's so many phenomena. I just met an interesting fellow recently I mentioned to you who's coming out with a book. And not to shamelessly plug it, but I think the book's name is What Are the Odds? He's pretty vocal about his testimony. Mike Lindell, My Pillow Lindell. Mike is launching a national recovery network with phone apps, access to resources. So he's stirring, not he, Mike, he is stirring the water. So doors are opening, and it is an exciting time in such a tragic time.
And who better to provide counsel and encouragement than those that have walked that way?
You know, it's really true. Yeah. And to be complimented by what are called allies. Allies are people that have a passion for treatment and recovery that may not, that haven't had an addiction history, maybe have a loved one has been it, but they've been somehow touched by the whole curse of the tragedy. But so it's kind of a team approach. Clinical professionals coupled with folks coming out of addiction, voices of recovery working together, and it takes a team.
Yeah. Speaking of team, just we got a couple minutes left. Say a bit about the R3 Collaborative. It's the letter 3, r3collaborative.org. What does that mean?
The three R's are, first R is for recovery. Recovery from addiction, coming out of treatment. The second R is reentry. That's reentering from incarceration, folks coming out of prison, and there's about an 80%, if not more, overlap. So those are the people we're trying to provide a network of resources for. The third R is my favorite, is renewal in Christ. And that's another key part of research. And not to be a biased Christian, but a faith component in a treatment program is a critical evidence-based practice, whether it's your higher power in a 12-step tradition or God. People think Hazelden's godless. You won't find the word higher power at Hazelton. You know what you find? God of your understanding. Now, in Teen Challenge and Union Gospel Mission Christ Recovery Center, we put a name on the higher power, you know, but what's critical is think of it as a vacuum inside. And if all you do is get sober, then you've just pushed away what you're trying to get rid of. But if you don't replace it with something, what's that old line? Nature abhors a vacuum. Yeah. How long are you going to hold your breath and push it away? Fill it with a new life. That's why the reentry and recovery is about get a job, get a certification, get some training. But if you don't fill it with God, something bigger than you are, again, Neil, how long are you going to hold your breath?
Yeah. Jim Moore is a leader in the area of recovery and renewal in Christ. The R3 Collaborative is a great resource to make the first connection. Or Minnesota Teen Challenge, you can connect with them as well. We recommend it if you know someone that is facing an addiction, needs some help, check out Teen Challenge or go to r3collaborative.org. Jim Moore, so appreciate you.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
And tell them about the Freedom Portal, 612.
Okay.
612 Freedom. I'd like to give that out. That's the Teen Challenge access number. That's what I mean by portal. If you have a loved one who's struggling, if you are struggling, 612-FREEDOM, that'll put you right into Teen Challenge. You get the counseling, the support, the guidance you need.
Mm. Now, someone today is hopefully going to make that call.
I think they
might need it. Jim Moore with us today. It's Faith Radio Mornings, and it's 3 minutes before top of the hour, we'll wrap up hour one in just a moment. Well, a great way to start a Thursday morning. I hope you agree. Had a good conversation earlier this hour with Ben Johnson from the Acton Institute, talking about what's going on in Europe, abortion decision in Ireland, and new socialist government in Spain, and even talked a little bit about millennials. Maybe got graduation going on, a graduation ceremony. Robert Orban says it is an event where the commencement speaker tells thousands of students dressed in identical caps and gowns that individuality is the key to success.
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.